last time we got to Kehelles in the second Perek, and we got up to Pasuk Tesvav, which is verse 15 of the second chapter. And we talked about the idea that the fate of the fool would be like the fate of the wise man. And he basically had this idea that what's the point of me becoming righteous if I can just live like a fool? Basically, essentially, why shouldn't I live like a fool and just, have a simple hedonistic path where I can derive pleasure from the world? And we said that he doesn't have any light to guide his inclination or wisdom to direct his judgment, and that he will literally live in a very reckless manner by doing such. But he was kind of contemplating, well, so what? So what? So let's say I do live like that. mind of community, like, what's the big difference if I do live like that? At the end of the day, we're all going to die anyway. And, it's hard work to live like a tzaddik, as Esav said. Why should I push myself so hard to do something which, at the end of the day, doesn't seem to be particularly useful? So, here's the answer. So, we're now in the second Perek, verse 16. That's chapter 2, Pasuk Tes Zayin. It says, Ki ein zichrein lachachem im haksil la'olam. There is no comparison in the world between the remembrance of someone who's considered a wise person and that of the fool. Now, when it says la'olam in the world, it doesn't mean this world. You're right. If it's all about olam hazeh, and that would be the end of it, you're quite right to come to such a conclusion, says Solomon. Not a bad idea. The thing is, this world ain't it. This is going to be followed by Olam HaNeshamos and then Olam HaBa. Olam HaNeshamos is where we await resurrection, and then post-resurrection, the world to come is this world with evil removed, and that will be permanent and infinite. And the remembrance of a wise person in Olam HaBa will be significantly different to the memory of a fool in Olam HaBa. For as the succeeding days go by, all is forgotten. How can the wise man's death be like a fool's? How's he answering up the Esav-like attitude, saying, oh, for goodness sake, you're wasting your time, just drink and be merry? The answer is that according to our sources, especially see Exodus 32:13 as well, which discusses this in the Medrash Rabbah associated with it, where it's talking about, I'm going to remember Avraham, I'm going to remember Yitzhak, I'm going to remember Yaakov, etc. In the future, everything will be forgotten save the teachings of the wise. Remember, when God reveals himself properly by taking gloves off, he's going to remove the barriers between you and him. He's got to, in order to reveal himself. When he does that, what you're really going to be able to cash in is your God consciousness and your wisdom. Foolishness and folly will cease to exist immediately. So the concept of who won the FA Cup doesn't mean anything. The actual practice is folly in and of itself. No one will be interested. Someone who's ignorant will be forgotten, even if they were very, very wealthy. So it's a grave mistake, says Solomon, to compare the death of a fool with that of a learned person. And whoever lives on in our memories and whose merit will shield us from evil in Olam Haba will be greatly praised in Olam Haba. Now, that's where essentially we left off last week. After learning that a wise sage does not, in fact, die, but lives on in Olam Haba, he continues in Yud Zayin. I hated life because the work that is wrought under the sun is grievous to me. All is futile and a vexation of the spirit. An interesting idea. Shlomi, can you be quiet, please? Now, what's going on here? I would not have made this claim, says Solomon, had I deemed life in this world to be something of value. But I'm telling you that in and of itself, says Solomon, life in and of this world is useless. Solomon is extremely bothered by the way people go about their lives. He's looked at people. Remember, for quite a long time, he was walking around as a commoner, knocking on people's doors and taking shelter there, where people thought he was a madman pretending to be the king. He wasn't. He really was the king, and he had been usurped. But he was learning a lot about how people live during that time who weren't brought up in the royal court. They were commoners. It says the average man, in his experience, ignores the necessity to care for his spiritual welfare. That is a sheer title in and of itself, I think. Regular folk, even those that are quote-unquote religious, tend to second-rate ruchnius, spirituality, against gashmius, against physicality, let alone those who are not religious at all. And they don't acknowledge that many of life's problems actually stem from their desire for physical pleasures. A lot of what people are going through is actually a cycle of lust fulfillment one way or another. So he says, I hated life. What's the work that is wrought? What's this work that is wrought? So he says that really what's going on here is that that means matters pertaining to the world under the sun. All the work you do to do things physically, to build your house, to organise your food, to obtain clothing. But actions which cause light to radiate in the upper world, they're not the bother. I'm not bothered by that. Those actions such as keeping mitzvahs, cleaning your house for Pesach, keeping Purim, these actual mitzvahs, I'm not talking about that. What he is saying is time that is used in order to fulfill worldly pleasures is wasted. And in that respect, he didn't hate his life. He's never regretting a mitzvah. He's regretting that which was useless. Important rule, worth coming moment. Regret has the built-in divine function of erasing whatever it is you regret. God built it into the system. If you truly and sincerely regret doing a sin, it's wiped off your slate. The damage is done, but your culpability to pay for it is forgiven. If you regret an aveira, it's off your bill. Warning. If you regret a mitzvah, it's also off your bill. One of the biggest yetzaharas that we really don't think about is we do a mitzvah and then regret doing it. I gave tzedakah. Ach, maybe that's not going to go where I thought it was going to go. You just lost the mitzvah because you regretted it. Abraham famously had 10 tests. The truth is he had 11. He had 11. The yetzaharah realized that there was no way he was going to be able to stop Avraham from taking his son and sacrificing him. He tried really hard. And he turned up as a very old, pious man, disguised as a pious man. And he walked up to Yitzhak and says, can I have a word with you? He says, big chassid, looks like a very, very pious man. And he goes, look, if your father wants to kill you for his own spiritual gain, you shouldn't die to pay for someone else's ruchnius. Very Torah-based argument. You know, if he wants to ascend in spirituality, you don't have to die to pay for that. And also, he's been preaching to you, this is not the way. Clearly something's wrong. Maybe you want to talk this over with him. Yitzhak Avinu didn't care. He was going straight for it. He couldn't stop these two going ahead. What did he do? He flew over to his wife, Sarah, and he got Og Melech HaBashan to tell Sarah that Avraham was shechting Yitzhak, and she died of fright. He killed her through shock. Why did he do that? When Avraham Avinu has done this most amazing deed ever, the Akedah is going to be one of the most supernormal, impossible deeds. There's a whole shiur about that, why that is. He came back and he found his wife dead. And people said, yeah, Oig told Sara about what you were doing up there, and she dropped dead in fright. Now, at that moment, he had another Yetzer Hara. Had he have known that doing that would kill his most precious wife, would he have done it? That's why the Pasuk says he didn't weep for her very much. He wept, but not, if Hashem would tell me to do it again, I'd do it again. Because he knew if he regretted the Akedah, the merit of binding Isaac would be undone. So he couldn't regret it. But that was a huge test for him, and one which most people don't give him the credit and understand that was a massive test. He'd have thought, my gosh, had I only known, I never would have done it. Regret wipes out whatever it is you're regretting. You can wipe out mitzvahs, you can wipe out aveiras. Never regret mitzvahs you've done, always regret the aveiras you've done. Yud Ches, 18. I hated all the labor that I labored under the sun. That I've got to leave it to someone who's going to be after me. I tell you what really irks me, says Solomon. I work hard to build a house, to get a nice car, to do all these things. And when I die, there's going to be people who I don't even know that might even bicker over who's going to get my stuff. Or maybe there'll be family members that fight amongst themselves over my inheritance, and I can't even absolutely say what's going to happen. So I worked so hard for it, and I can't even have a say in who I even leave it to. All my life's work, my business, my shares, my computer software, everything I've worked at, has to remain behind for someone else to make use as they wish. And they can squander it so they so wish. Only my Torah learning and my diligence in mitzvah performance are actually going to stay with me. That's all that's really mine that can't be taken away. Because I was wise and I utilized my time as best as I could for Torah and mitzvahs while I was alive, those things I get to take a lot of profit. But when I've been working in Gashmias, in physicality, I realize deep down that I'm toiling for someone else. And I'm not even going to be the person who's going to get it. And I can't even say who's going to get it. And I can't say what they're going to do with it. All that work for what? For some kid to misuse? So I put it in a trust fund. And it gets, one thing leads to another, gets stolen by the trust fund. Nobody ever gets it. All the money goes to some hedge fund that they dilly. Ugh, I don't have any control. I don't have control over what's going on. Very interesting idea. So he's really resenting the objects he can't hold on to permanently. People resent that. You know, they work hard for beautiful objects and they spend a lot of money on these objects. But the problem is that they can't keep them. And he feels that's an evil in the world. All that work for what? For what? Yud Tes. Umi yodeh hachacham yihiyeh oy zachal. And who knows whether he's going to be wise or foolish? That's an interesting point. A person is born, who knows what's going to become of him? Now this, remember, is touching on the concept of who's in control. Don't question God's ways as we don't see or understand the bigger picture. That was theme two. Theme one was experience all the world firsthand to know for sure that it's nothing but Tyra that's of worth. Theme two is, what's going on here? Who's really in control? This is very much now coming up to the end of the Perek, theme two stuff here. Who's going to get my stuff? Is the guy that's going to get my land and my car and my iPad, is he wise? Will he use it correctly at least? Or is he a fool and will he squander it? He's going to rule over all my possessions for which I toiled so hard and I've shown myself to be wise. And this too is futility. What a waste of time. So really the problem is that it doesn't really make a difference to me who's going to take my possessions. My worry is that I don't want all the time that I've invested into all to be wasted because I use it to the best of my ability and this person may not. I can't even leave a decent legacy. I can't guarantee my legacy. Verse 20. I turned my heart to despair of all that I had achieved by laboring under the sun. That's physical things. Now, he isn't bearing any grudges. That's really important. He didn't care about the fate of where all of his money went. Oh, he's going to take the car. All right, so he's going to take the car. But rather, he abandoned those feelings. He was like, he gave up worrying about who's going to get what. And he had a lot. He had a lot of money and a lot of wealth. Who's going to dilly it up? Really, it's in his despair, he ceased to worry about the future and any notion he had about being able to control the destiny of his wealth. He realized there's no point setting up trust funds. There's no point. It's not going to work. The world changes, things change. And you can't guarantee who's going to get what. So if you stay up all night worrying who's going to get the car, who's going to get the house, who's going to get my clothing, who's going to get my Rolex, doesn't mean anything anyway. You might as well just let go. Chof Aleph 21. Oh, this is an interesting pasuk. Not that they're not all interesting, but it's got some very deep ideas associated with it. For there is a man who has labored with wisdom, knowledge, and skill, yet he must hand over his portion to the man who has not toiled in it. And that too is a futility, for rot a rubber and a big evil, a great evil. There's a Gemara in Chagiga, Daf Tes Vov Omad Aleph, that's 15a. It's a very famous Gemara. It's quoted by Pirkei Avos as well in the Mishnah. Everyone has a portion that is set aside in both the Garden of Eden and Gehenna, which is both in Olam HaNeshamos. Olam HaNeshamos only has three postcodes. It's Gehenna, and then it's the lower level of the Garden of Eden and the upper level of the Garden of Eden, as we learnt in the Maamar HaIkarim at the end of Derech Hashem, in the essay on Gemul, on recompense. And if he's worthy, he not only acquires his own portion in the Garden of Eden, but he can get someone else's who's forfeited it. And we learn that out from a Gemara in Tarnis, Daf Chof Hei Amud Aleph, with Rav Elazar ben Padas, who asked for that. He asked for that. Let's say there's a Rosha that's going to go to Gehenna, he's not going to get Gan Eden, because of his choices that he's made. Well, that Gan Eden goes going. It's like a lottery who gets it. A Kodesh Baruch Hu appoints it to people that deserve more. So it might be that you not only get your plot, but someone else's plot, that they've forsaken it. That can happen. You can lose your plot. One has been set aside for you in escrow based upon your ability to live up to earning it. If God, as the Barbanel says, if God says you're going to get a great year for your crops, you can't just go to Portugal and put your feet up and drink pina colada. You've got to go reap and sow and plow and winnow. You've got to do your stuff. Then you'll get the bracha. But if you don't, you're not going to get it, even though God set it aside for you. The fact that God set aside a portion in Gan Eden for you doesn't mean you're going to get it. It just means if you live up to it, you've got a place to go to. That's what it means. There's no guarantee based on you. That's what it means. He might have to hand over his portion. See what's being said here? This is very deep. Let's say a person is undeserving to get their plot in the Garden of Eden, in Olam HaNeshamos, while they're waiting resurrection. It's going to go to someone else who he's never met. His spiritual reward will go to someone else. His portion is connected with the phrase, to the man who has not toiled it. And Shlomo is explaining here in Keheles, the one who does not work merits the portion of his predecessor. Because let's say you inherit Plony's Gan Eden, you didn't work to get what would be his Gan Eden. The other guy was working towards it and then lost it with something. So now it's been given to you. That's horrendous. That's horrendous. So he's asking, so what use is it for man to toil? Why should he remain empty-handed after all of his hard work? My plot isn't even guaranteed, even in mitzvahs, unless I really keep up. Amazing idea. Can I share something with you? very interesting idea here. There's a Gra, Rabbi Eliyahu Kramer of Vilna, the famous Vilna Gaon. And he says an amazing idea, which I'd like to share with you. And he brings it on this pasuk, quoting the Medrash Rabbah. And he writes it in the Igeres HaGra, the letter of the Gra. And he quotes the Gemara in Erevin, Daf Nun Dalad Amud Aleph, which is 54a. And he says there's another reason why it's futile to accumulate wealth for the purpose of giving it to one's kids. I'm going to make a bit of money and give the kids something. He says like this. He says, that's not wise. He says, people, says the Gra, are like blades of grass in a field. Some blades grow, and others, for whatever reason, wither and die. As your children grow, their means of support grows with them, because they've got their own personal bank account with God anyway. It's not just yours. It's not just you giving them the start. They get their own account. So you don't have to worry they're going to lack sustenance. That's Rashi on that Gemara. Now, everyone's station in life is determined by the circumstances in which God placed him by providence. The cards that you've been dealt at birth are sorted by God. Rather, you should ensure that your children will lead righteous lives of Torah and mitzvahs, because it's the only thing which will really guarantee wealth long term. If you're really worried about their wealth, give them a strong basis in Torah and mitzvahs, because that will lead to genuine long-term wealth. The Chofetz Chaim in Shem Olam says that many people try to secure a financial future for their daughters by trying to get them to marry a businessman who's wealthy rather than a Torah scholar. And the Chofetz Chaim, quoting the same Gemara, says that a Torah scholar could very easily, become a businessman and do well. But an unlearned businessman is unlikely to develop into a Torah scholar. And it could have even been decreed that one's children aren't going to be wealthy anyway, in which case marrying off a daughter to a well-to-do businessman doesn't secure anything, because the kids are going to be destined to be relatively poor anyway. And you've lost out the fact that you didn't marry them to a Torah scholar. It's an interesting idea. So worrying about who's going to get what money and who I should marry kids to for money is a bit of a fallacy, says the Gra and the Chofetz Chaim together, saying, if you really want wealth, go with what Kehelis is telling you is going to get you wealth. If you're marrying purely for the money, know it's going to be extremely temporary and open to providential differences. Interesting idea. Pasuk Chof Beis, 22. Ki ma ivela adam b'cholamot. What is man from all of this toil, all this omel, all of this toil, mamish, hard toil, and the stress of his heart, which he toils under the sun? What's he getting out of all of it? He's asking, now this is huge. This pasuk is not to be understood literally. He's not just complaining again with another verse going, ach, it's all a lot. This is a very big point. It's huge. Okay, it's a big pasuk alert. How can I get, I've got to give this over, there's quite a deep idea. Solomon is saying to us, there's actually a very good reason to despair over all the work that you've done. Listen to this, it's kind of scary. You should emotionally brace yourself what we're about to say. Okay, keep it intellectual. Don't get scared by what he's going to say, but we got to know it. Even though Solomon says he's wise and he's putting spirituality first above the sun, which is the mitzvahs and the Torah. Nevertheless, he's still worried that maybe even his mitzvahs are working for someone else. And he ain't going to keep the money. What's going on there? Hear this point from the Al-Sheikh HaKadosh, quoting the Tikkun Zohar. The Tikkun Zohar number 34. Listen to this. You've got to hear it. It's big. We said earlier in the first parak that an individual may be reincarnated up to three times as a human, let's say, and come back time after time, sovev, spinning around the system until they've achieved some kind of perfection. Now, God may decide that the last person to possess a soul should be the one to be resurrected. A famous question I get asked a lot, especially in Derech Hashem. If you've had several reincarnations, which body do you come back in? It's a big question. There's two approaches to this, but we don't know the answer because it hasn't happened yet, and the way that it happens has bearing. That's very interesting. Or it could be that the last two people that you came back as each take a part of the soul and they're both resurrected, splitting up the spirit and the spiritual dividends associated with that account. To keep it fair. In either case, the first person who possessed that soul will be lost forever, according to that approach. It's only either the last two or the very last one that are in with a chance of splitting up all the work. And he may have labored honestly his whole life long in wisdom and knowledge, but he's not going to benefit from that, as only the latter incarnations will be fully resurrected. And the first guy has lost out forever, and he lived a whole life of Torah mitzvahs for nothing. Because he had to come back. He won't live in this world. He's dead. And he's not going to get resurrected either. He's literally gone. Going back to verse 21, it says, "For there is a man who has labored with wisdom, knowledge, and skill, but he does not merit to be resurrected." Listen. Shevet Ephraim, a good amount of the clan of Ephraim, miscalculated the date of the Mashiach and left Egypt early, and they were struck down by the Philistim, and they were killed, and their bodies were left out to rot. One of the reasons that God did not take the Jews on the most direct route up the coast of Egypt and through Gaza into Israel was the Jews would have seen their dead brethren slayed in the desert, get completely freaked out, turn around and run back to Egypt. So one of the reasons he took them south into the Sinai Peninsula was to avoid that route. Then we'll get them to go round through Syria, across the River Jordan, and get into Israel that way round from the east. Yeah? Now, later, the prophet Yechezkel, in the dry bones incident in the book of Ezekiel, was told to go there and resurrect Shevet Ephraim, all those individuals that died there, to bring them back into Klal Yisrael. It's a lot of people. So Ezekiel went there, and he prophesied over the bones, and the famous bone to bone, sinew to sinew. They all came back, and everyone, a whole troop, a host of warriors, was resurrected in their armor. There they are, standing there. And Yechezkel noticed that one skeleton on the floor didn't get resurrected. And he thought he'd made a mistake. So he turned round to the Bara Olam and said, "Bara Olam, you commanded me to come and resurrect this host, this people, and yet this man hasn't got up. Have I done something wrong?" God boomed at Yechezkel. He charged Ribbis. He shall not live. From that pasuk, we learn that a Jew that charges another Jew ribbis, interest, or a Jew that pays another Jew ribbis knowingly, forfeits being resurrected and life in the next world. That's how severe Ribas is. That's it. You lose your ticket. I do urge everyone that if they're taking loans from Jews or they're giving loans to Jews, to organise a heter iska for both of your sakes. Organise some kind of proper way of doing things halachically. You may work and put on tefillin and buy kashrus and improve your Shabbos and your home and your mezuzahs, but if you got ribbus that's gone unorganised or non-paid back or somehow it's not been seen to, you could lose the lot. Could all go. God does not like it. We see this. Let's talk about that. Let's talk about that bloke. Let's say he put on tefillin. He kept Pesach, let's say, everything. But then he charged ribbus. Well, he ain't coming back. Well, what about all the tefillin? What about all the matzahs? He's cleaning his house. Yeah. Toiled under the sun and above the sun, and yet for nothing. Solomon despairs. Oy vey, says Solomon. What's going to be, even though the mitzvahs he did, he doesn't keep, let alone the car and the iPad and the Gucci suit. That for sure don't stay. But the mitzvahs, he's lost that as well. That can happen. He could forfeit his chalik in Olam Haba. He could lose his portion in the world to come. Oh no! Terrible. Now there's a machlokas here. There's a machlokas as to who you get resurrected as. We don't know the answer. One side is the Alshech HaKadosh, who was a Talmud of the Arizal, on his Perush, on his commentary to Sefer Eiv, which is Job. Write this one down, very difficult to find. And it's on Eiv, Lamed Gimel Choftes. That's Eiv 33:29. Where Eiv also laments this. Says the Alshech HaKadosh, do not despair. Do not despair, says the Alshech. If you've been resurrected, if you've been reincarnated, everybody that's reincarnated comes back. So don't worry that the mitzvahs that you're doing in body number two will be lost to body number three. Body number two comes back and he gets to keep it on his account. Body number three gets to come back. They get to keep it on their account. And it's all going to be organized. That's the Alshech stance on this concept, and he bases it on sources. However, the Ari himself, the Alshech's Rebbe, on Shah Gilgulim, which is the gate of reincarnation, chapter 35 in the introduction, says that sometimes that's not the case. Sometimes only the last Gilgul gets it, and everyone else gets lost. Answer, we don't know. It depends how Mashiach will come, Be'achishena or Be'ito, in its time or earlier, and that will have a bearing on how the resurrection will take place and how God will do Tchias Mesim and Olam Haba. But there's risks here. Solomon is lamenting possible risks that it could be you work your socks off in spirituality and even that you lose. That's a proper risk. Scary, hey? In which case, what difference does it make as to the work I've done physically or spiritually? I could lose the lot anyway. Physically, I know I'm going to lose. So what have I got? What have I got? This horrendous situation where even my tefillin and my Shabbos and my sitters is gone. Chof Gimel, 23. Ki chol yomov, for all of his days, machayv mepain, for chas, and he's vexed in business. Gam belayla, even at night he doesn't sleep. He finds no rest. I say, says Solomon, the whole thing is hevel. What a futility is all this. All of your life you could labour to serve God above the sun. And you could undergo a lot of pain and suffering to get your Olam Haba. If you even get it. Business is a vexation. The body wears out and disintegrates. And even at night he can't sleep because he's always worried about things. Thinking this way is futility. If you think like this, that everything's a waste of time, thinking like that's a futility. That's what the Pasuk's saying. Don't think it is. To think like that, you're being silly. Hope is at hand. Chof Dalad. Now, this is one of those psukim where you might think you should ban Keheles because it seems to be read the wrong way. But hope is at hand. Don't worry. We'll go through it. Ein toiv ba'odom shiochel v'shosa. There's nothing good for man except eating and drinking. And he should make his soul enjoy pleasure for all of this work. Gam zeru isi ani ki miyad elokimi. This is what I've also seen from the hand of God. If you read this pasuk at face value, it seems to be a heksha to say go enjoy simple hedonism. And clearly we've seen from the first parak in the beginning of the second that that isn't what he means. You're going to misread this if you read this at face value. Now remember, what he said was that it's a futility to think that everything you're doing is worthless, even in Torah and mitzvahs, because you might not get it because of Gilgul issues. Says Solomon as follows. It would seem that you don't need to spend your days in pain and suffering, and you can just eat and drink to your satisfaction, and you can still get Olam Haba by keeping mitzvahs. When a soul leaves this world, the Bereishis Rabbah, Samach Beis Space, 62:2, says that the neshama is shown the reward that he has earned for all the toil that he's done on earth. And in Mishlei 31:25, Proverbs 31:25, says, and she laughs at the time to come. That's the neshama in the feminine, laughing at just realizing just how much it was able to do for things that seem very, very trivial, like putting one coin in a box, not realizing just how much it's earned for itself. And even if your body doesn't merit resurrection, and even if it's had the benefit of living in this world, the soul will earn a place in the next. But, says Solomon, it's not worthwhile for the body to enjoy life by eating and drinking because it's from the hand of God. The fact that he can even eat and drink to his heart's desire and then still be able to merit some kind of bliss is a gift from Hashem. And he'll talk about that more in the third chapter, in the 13th verse. That's why it's a rule when you're learning Keheles to not misquote single pasukim. You've got to see the whole picture of the perek first, because you'll say, look, even your Torah tells you to eat, go, be merry. That's not the whole truth. You might quote chapter 2, verse 24 as a reason to indulge, but it's not straightforward. That's what he's saying. Look at Chof Hei. Ki mi yachol mi yachush chutz mimenu. Who will eat? Or who will enjoy, if not me many, if not me? What does it mean? What does that mean? I know that if I go out to have a steak, it's me that enjoys it. Is this what the wisdom of Solomon is telling us? Do I need that? Do I need Solomon to tell me I enjoy my own stuff? Solomon is saying, no one had more food on his table than me. It says, in fact, if you look up Malachim Aleph, Kings 1, Hay, base. Chapter 5, verse 2, it says there was no one that had food with more delicacies on his table than Solomon. It was extreme. Yet with all this, he was unhappy because he was troubled by the thoughts that we've just said in verse 22. I may not even get resurrected. So what's it all for? The truth of the matter is that a deeply thinking person won't get any pleasure from indulging in food and drink, because Chof Vav says, "Kila Adam Shatov Lefana Nosan Chochma, Vadas V'Simcha." For to the man that is good in his sight, he grants wisdom, knowledge, and joy. But to the sinner, He gives a job of gathering and heaping up, that he may leave it to one who is good before God. A sinner may be used by God to gather up merits that he wants to give to someone else because he likes the other guy. So if this guy's living, you know what? At least I get him to do something beneficial. This is also futility and a vexation of spirit. There are those who are deserving, and to those people God grants wisdom, knowledge, and spiritual joy, which is not always so associated with physical joy. You can have a lack of physical joy and still be besimcha spiritually. Now, sinners may have pleasure in enjoying this earth. God does give. I've got news for you. Adolf Hitler was vegetarian for ethical reasons. I love telling vegetarians that. Great, hey? He was an ethical vegetarian. And he enjoyed his food. When it came time to have lunch, he got good food. Kodesh Baruch Hu's giving him pleasure, though. He's giving him pleasure. They're given the choice to perform mitzvahs and do good because that's what they're here for. And you might work hard, gathering and heaping, but in the end, all the mitzvahs he did will be given over to someone else after him. Because he's such a sinner, he's not going to get any pleasure from his work because God's going to take it away from him. Because as we saw earlier on in verse 19, 20 and 21, the remembrance of a sinner or a fool isn't going to last anyway. So the good that he did do, God gives over like cards to someone else. Hey, look, take this. He ain't going to have it, so you might as well have it. But give it to those who are fitting. Bottom line at the end of this perek, we finished the perek. You can't question God's methods because only God really knows a person's character and what they deserve it of and what they're not deserving of. Now, you might think Joey is wicked and he's terrible, but in the eyes of God, he's a perfectly righteous person. To such a person, he'll grant that person goodness and wealth and joy and all these wonderful things, wisdom. To someone he considers to be a sinner, he'll give him the job of gathering and heaping. And don't be surprised if you see a person working hard and making a lot of money and having a good time, but leaving it over to someone else. It might appear very strange to us on the ground in real time, but God's got his reasons as to why he's giving this good over to this person. You don't know why he's amassing this. It's his way of punishing men for their sins and rewarding the righteous for their deeds. You can't fathom or comprehend the complex depth of the entire system. So it's not our place to criticize God's ways or the unfair treatment we see some people have. It isn't as if God's not in control. He knows what's going on. It's not random. While we're talking about God being in control, Solomon goes further down this route and starts asking fundamental questions of fatalism. Is there a Beshet? Is there fate? And if so, is there anything I can do to undo it? And if not, why am I toiling at all? I might as well sit back and coast. If it's really all a matter of fate and it's organized, why should I work hard? The whole theme of the third perek is the question of fate and the existential question of the effects of our free will. Can we really change things? Asks Solomon, which is very much on the back of this last pasuk that we've just done. This pasuk number 23, 24, 25, 26 are all touching upon the idea of fate. Let's dig in to the beginning of the third perek and start to see, it's a very famous bit that's been taken by Christians as a song actually. Let's start to see what's going on here with the question of fate. L'kol zaman v'eis l'kol chefetz tachas ha-shamayim. It's very, very interesting. This pasuk aleph, verse 1, really is a theme that goes all the way to the ninth pasuk. This is nine pasukim, all wrapped up into one pasuk. To everything there's a season, and there is a time to every purpose under heaven. In which case, why are you working? It's all pre-laid out. Solomon starts to delve into this idea. There is a sefer called Shah HaMazalos, the Gate of Constellations or Destiny. And there's a debate about the issue of fate and providence. And the Rambam in Shmona Prokim in the seventh perek says that there's the naivety of those who believe that mazal affect our lives. Because if that would be the case, the Torah would have no meaning at all. There's no concept of reward or punishment. You're just going to go through a system where you've got no choice and you can't be rewarded or punished. You're just a robot. Now, let's pretend for a second, devil's advocate, that there's truth in the notion of destiny being unwavering. Then how could the Torah command us to put a murderer to death? The murderer could claim in court, holding a sefer Torah, he has no choice. He was born under the astrological sign of bloodshed and was destined to become a murderer against his will. And the victim was born under the astrological sign from the day of his birth that he was destined to die from that man. The whole thing's predestined. And there's no point affecting me. You can't claim against me. I was born to be a murderer. He was born to die at my hand. What do you want me to do? Why are you putting me to death? Good question, no? In fact, the whole concept of a judiciary at all falls to bits. And that's a question because the Gemara in Sanhedrin, Daf Samach Gimel, says that one of the Sheva Mitzvos B'nai Noach, the seven Noachide laws that Gentiles have to abide by, is setting up Botei Dinim, houses of judgment, to enforce the laws of the Torah for them. Well, what's the point? The whole thing's a farce. That's what Solomon is postulating in this first pasuk. Now, again, you might think to ban Keheles, because if you just look at that and go, it's all predestined, do what you want. Whoa, it's a whole work. You can't misquote Pesukim from Keheles. You've got to know what the whole theme is. There's so much here. When HaKadosh Baruch Hu made the heavens and the earth, he organized all the planets and the zodiac and understands their influence on earth. And he knows how every person will act and whether he'll merit reward or punishment for his actions from before the time of creation. He knows everything. But in his wisdom, he arranged the heavens so that each person would fit into the life of their star sign. So let's understand this. And this is a very important Al-Sheikh and the Rambam. The Rambam. You've got to understand this. This is which came first, the chicken or the egg? Is it a man's destiny or is it man's choices that affect his destiny? The Rambam seems to say that God moves the stars and planets and puts souls in a fetus just at the right moment according to the as yet unmade choices that the person has not yet made. Because from God's perspective, they're making it now. Can you hear this? People think because I'm born under the sign of bloodshed, I'm going to naturally have a tshuka to see blood, right? True. The only reason God born you under the sign of bloodshed is because those are the choices you're going to make. So he put you in the world under the sign of bloodshed to manifest your choices before you made them. Who can understand? That is intense. Really? Is that what he does? Yeah. The fate you choose for yourself through your own choices then becomes the destiny he sets for you. Why does he do that? What's going on? That's the Rambam. That's the Al-Sheikh. That's the Medrash. They're all saying the same thing. So which came first, the chicken or the egg? It turns out the chicken. And because the chicken came first, it lays eggs. No, but the chicken, what? But where did the chicken come from? The chicken's made its own choices. So God made the chicken first. People make their own choices. He sees the choices and he puts them into the earth at the moment. He conceives them and borns them at that moment to fit in with all the choices they're making in their life. And then they go live it. Then after they don't feel bad about what God's going to do with them. But that actually could raise more questions than it answers. Aushi HaKadosh, the Ari HaKadosh, the Vilna Gaon all say the signs, the zodiacal signs are arranged by God according to how a person's life is going to be lived. That is one of the most super deep ideas of providence that's imagined. How exceedingly deep is that? It's a conundrum. But it's the case. It must be the case. Because if the signs were going to dictate in your life the choices that you may not have made, and they're forcing you to make a choice, then all the teichacha of the Torah, all the reproof of the Torah and admonition would be useless. It wouldn't make any sense because you could claim it's not my fault. The signs are leading me there. So it must be this way. Otherwise, a Torah would never chide us. Shlomo is referring to this operating system when he says to everything there is a season and there is a time to every purpose. The time that he's alluding to is the zodiacal signs which are allotted to every purpose and thing under the heavens. Because we know, and Derech Hashem, we had a whole chapter on this, every object on the physical earth has its future contained within the star signs. And there is a star sign for everything, as all the following verses show. Everything. Now, from verse 2 to verse 8, which is a song that people sing, he's just telling you, there's a star for this, there's a star for that, there's a star for this, there's a star for that. It's all mazal. When he means eis loledes va'eis lamus, there's a time to be born and there's a time to die in verse 2, that time says the Mefushim, based upon the first pasuk, because all of these pasukim are one pasuk, it's just the first pasuk, means a star sign. So read it, there's a star sign to be born, there's a star sign to die, there's a star sign to plant, a star sign to uproot, there's a star sign to kill, there's a star sign to heal, there's a star sign to break down, there's a star sign to build up, one to laugh, one to mourn, one to dance, one to cast away stones, one to gather stones, a star sign to embrace at a simcha, a star sign to refrain from embracing, a star sign to lose, a star sign to seek, a star sign to keep, a star sign to lose, a star sign to tear, a star sign to sow, a star sign to keep silent, to speak, to love, to hate, to work. It's all under the stars. Pasuk Tes. So what profit is there? If there's a star sign for everything, where do I fit in? Where's my choice? That's Pasuk Tes. My Yisrael Isa Bashawama, what's the point of me working? If you're telling me there's a star sign for every single human experience, then who am I? It's a rhetorical question. It's a rhetorical question. Since time and the star signs are used to control the destiny of people, what use is it to study Torah and perform mitzvahs? Which is the whole thing of Perek Aleph and Beis. That's the only thing I'm going to keep, right? I was destined to learn that Torah anyway. Now, it's known for a fact that a person's lifespan can be lengthened, providing that it does not contradict the star signs that he's born under. And we see that both Abaye and Rava lived longer because they studied Torah and did good deeds. That's a Gemara Rosh Hashanah, Daf Yud Ches Omet Aleph. Hashem extended their days as a reward for the Limud Torah. And offering sacrifices, though, does not prolong one's days. Hashem didn't penalize us with a shorter lifespan when he decreed that the Beis HaMikdash was going to be destroyed, knowing we wouldn't be able to give Korbanos either. Think about it. If Korbanos could lengthen our lifespan, then destroying the Beis HaMikdashim is going to be killing people prematurely because they couldn't give kabbonis. So he didn't do it like that. You want to lengthen your life, there's honouring your parents, sending away the mother bird, learning Torah, doing mitzvahs, striving in Torah, Shem will add days to your life. We know there are certain things to do that. You don't need to worry, oh, I don't have the Beis HaMikdash. True, without the Beis HaMikdash, we can't atone for certain averus. That's true, it's a problem. We mourn for that on Tisha B'Av. But it doesn't mean that your lifespan is being curtailed. only Torah and good deeds really have the long-term power to increase your lifespan, both in this world and the next. And we know that there are rewards awaiting the soul in Shemayim, but you can't get it in this world. So what use is all of man's work if his destiny has ultimately been predetermined by fate? That's the question. Answer is in Pasuk Yud. We've got a few minutes and Yud Aleph. Let's try to conclude with these. There's quite a lot to say on these, so I won't be able to finish this tonight, but we've done a tremendous amount. I'm very happy with the amount that we've covered, but we've got some themes together. Let's have a look at Yud. Well, Isiasinian, I've seen an idea. I've seen a task. Which God has given the sons of man to concern themselves with. Let's look at 11. He has made everything beautiful, be'itoi, in its time, in its mazal, in its destiny, in its star sign. And also, he set the world in their heart so that man cannot appreciate the work that God has done from beginning to end. He's put an enigma into creation. Everything has been made according to God's plan. It's perfectly executed. And he's arranged that the birth of each human fits in exactly with the sign that he's born under based upon how he's going to live his life. That's the system he uses to keep distant from humans so they don't feel his presence so they can have Bechira. He can't get too close, so he uses the stars as like a machine so that every action he's going to do is not going to contradict his life as foretold by the stars. How do we know this? Because Abraham argued with God. He had a full argument and he had a tina. He prayed to God as follows. God, he was a master astrologer. He wrote Sefer Yetzirah, which a lot of that is astrology. He said to God like this. I've looked into my star sign and I've seen I'm infertile. I'm not destined to have any children with Sarai. God says, you're quite right. So how can you say you're going to give me children? They're going to be so many of them. They're going to be uncountable, like the sand on the sea and the stars in heaven. If I'm not fertile, where's that promise going? So Avraham Avinu's mazal was set to be infertile. But God took him out of that mazal to show you can override your mazal through mitzvah performance. That's part of the system. That's how he deals with Sadiqim. He goes, yeah, I do usually put you in the system based upon your decisions, but if you supercharge yourself, I'll deal with you directly through another providence and not through the mazal system. Why? Because it's not going to affect your bechira. Someone's allowed to wreak a miracle. They can do a miracle if their bechira won't be affected. The Bava Sali, Zochot Tzadik Livrocha, would every Shabbos pour hundreds of people a kiddush cup out of one bottle of wine, which you would cover in a serviette. People would come from all over the world to have that kiddush wine. Because it's impossible. It's like Elisha's miracle with the oil. How can hundreds of people be poured out a full cup from one bottle? He'd do it every single week. It wasn't a one-off. It was normal. Why? Because his bechira won't be shifted. If you could do it, you might go, oh my gosh, I've got to up my mitzvahs. But for him on that higher operating level, it's normal. For Avraham Avinu, it's normal to override his stars. For most people, not so. It's normal to be in the natural system of the world. I'll finish with one idea. Shlomo's saying as follows, basically, in these two psukim. Shlomo's wisdom perceived that however large the world may be, and however many people it ends up containing, billions of people, everyone and everything is governed and accommodated in the great plan that's been laid out. And he has set into the hearts of people that they come to believe in God, even though they don't understand the work he's done. Comprehension is no prerequisite for compliance. Because we don't comprehend something doesn't mean we don't do it. Most people don't know how a paracetamol works. Most pharmacists I've asked don't have a clue as to the actual system of anesthetic that's going on. The analgesic effect of is not clearly understood of paracetamol. But you know what? It works. Forget it. I'll just take it. But if you don't know about it, why don't you know what? You don't know how the world works anyway. We still don't know what gravity is. Is it a force? Is it a wave? Is it a particle? We don't know. It works. We'll work with it. We said at the giving of the Torah, Na'aseh v'nishma. We'll do it. And if we can, we'll understand it. We didn't say nishma. And if we nishma it, we'll na'aseh it. If we get it, we'll keep it. No. The Reform do that. The Reform say, if it makes sense to us, we'll keep on with it. I'll wash my hands before bread. It's hygienic. Because kahanim, nonsense. I won't do it. God's put enigma. You know what? You're not going to get the complexity of the world system, but you'll still see me enough in it to do what I'm asking you to do. What we're going to talk about, this is quite a big pasuk, in the next three or four pasukim, is the concept of how God actually interfaces with the world to manifest a basic outline of fate, but keep it elastic enough for you to override any choices you may want to make and change yourself. Absolutely incredible thing, how the system works. It's quite an amazingly designed, elastic system, which has a predestined path that you're going to be Caucasian or black or Chinese, but you could completely change who you are within that framework. And how that works, and how the Mazal system, the ACE system, the Mazal, the time system, has to be reconfigured or overridden based upon human choices, and yet the whole system can't break. It can't be brittle. It's got to be pliable enough to deal with the fact that people may not go in a fixed way. And that is going to be the discussion for next time. So we finished up. We'll go back to verse 11, Pasuk Yud Aleph, next time, and hopefully finish that up. And then really cut into a good chunk of the third parak. I mean, I've got ambitions. Maybe we could even finish the third parak next time, which is this question of fate. And then we'll get on to the themes of the fourth parak, which tie on for this as we'll do. Thank you very, very much for taking up your time for being here. And I really appreciate you being here. Again, this is the beginning of the second term. Please do register if you can. And I look forward to seeing you next time. If there